Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
State lawmakers are forging ahead with a major water plan meant to address toxic algae blooms. That's also a top priority for Senate President Joe Negron.
This is something that was not an act of God. We did this to ourselves.
Also tonight, the Florida Senate seems ready to go along with a statewide fracking ban. The House, maybe not so much.
Large landowners won't have a choice. They'll be forced to bring dozens of high-profile, expensive takings lawsuits against the state. They'll do this because the bill will take their property rights as soon as it becomes law.
We'll also get the latest on the workers' compensation rate fight, an either-or juvenile justice bill that's causing contention in the House, and the possibility more money for charter schools could mean more local property taxes. I'm Tom Flanagan. On day two of the Florida 2017 lawmaking session, this is Capitol Report. One of the most controversial spending programs of this year's session passed its second committee stop today. Nick Evans reports the reservoir project, championed by Senate President Joe Negron, raises conflicting concerns with supporters and opponents.
An hour before lawmakers arrived for the Senate's environmental spending panel, the hallway outside the third floor committee room was stifling, packed full with men and women in fluorescent yellow shirts, voicing support for Senate President Joe Negron's reservoir. When staffers opened the door, they let people in one at a time to keep the room at occupancy. The issue drawing all these people to the Capitol was the subject of an emergency declaration last year, toxic algae blooms.
Normally, when the governor issues a state of emergency, some act of God has occurred.
This is Senator Rob Bradley.
We did this to ourselves. The guacamole water was released from Lake Okeechobee by human decisions and then dumped on our neighbors and made them sick and made their lives miserable.
The Fleming Island Republican is well known in the chamber for shepherding complex and controversial measures. And this year, he's taking the reins for a massive water storage plan.
This has been quite a journey so far. We're only in day two of session. And I feel like many of us have gotten to get to know each other pretty well.
But since the measure got started, there have been significant changes. In a 40-page amendment, Bradley tacked on water projects throughout the state to build additional support. The new bill dedicates funding to the Keys and to the St. Johns River in Bradley's backyard. It also incorporates parts of a septic tank to sewer program backed by Governor Rick Scott. Many of the public speakers voiced support for the plan, like Amber Moreno, who focuses on the environmental situation in the area and its impact on local economies.
So in the summer of 2016, I moved from my hometown of Delray Beach to Stuart, Florida, and for the first time, I saw the floodgates of hell open up. I watched my friends and family become sick. I saw the beautiful marine life slowly suffer and die. Boat captains, eco-tour guides, fishermen, and many of my friends have lost their job, and our local economy plummeted.
Those speaking against the proposal point to the economy as well. But more often they focus on the precarious employment situation in the area. Bohokie City Manager Chandler Williamson argues taking agricultural land out of production would hurt his community.
The city of Bohokie within itself has about 19% unemployment. As vibrant as the lanes is for sugarcane, sweet corn, and we are the epic center for agricultural production, this bill would not only significantly impact us directly economically, it would pretty much sink the Glades.
It's an issue highlighted by Minority Leader Oscar Brainin, the only lawmaker to vote against the proposal. And speaking from the floor later in the day, Senate President Negron opened the door to addressing economic concerns in the region.
And my expectation is that, in the next part of session that we'll be able to come forward with a comprehensive proposal that addresses economic concerns in the Glades community on several levels. So I'm very optimistic.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
The Senate is moving ahead with a statewide ban on hydraulic fracturing, despite industry threats of a blizzard of lawsuits. But as Jim Ash reports, the House remains a big question mark.
Once again, a Senate committee was jammed to the rafters with environmental activists worried about hydraulic fracturing. But this time, they were there to celebrate the debut of a Republican-sponsored statewide ban. As she stepped to the lectern to introduce her bill, Senator Dana Young of Tampa displayed a cylindrical core sample of Florida limestone. The rock was riddled with holes and proof, Young says, fracking doesn't belong in Florida.
This bill is concise and straightforward. It bans all types of fracking. It bans hydraulic fracking, acid fracking, and matrix acidizing.
And instead of a sea of grim faces, panel members saw mostly smiles.
Hello. Again, my name is Michelle Allen. I am the Florida organizer with Food and Water Watch. I just want to start by thanking you, Chairwoman Book, for and committee members for considering this legislation. And I'm here today on behalf of our 60,000 Florida supporters to urge you to vote yes on Senate Bill 442.
Susan Glickman, a lobbyist representing the Everglades Coalition, could hardly contain her glee.
We know that these well stimulation methods use millions of gallons of fresh water. We know there are also hundreds of chemicals that have adverse impacts. So it's very important.
This time, the few sour faces belong to a small knot of lobbyists representing corporate Florida and the oil and gas industry. The list of opponents included the Florida Petroleum Council, ExxonMobil, the Florida Chamber of Commerce, the James Madison Institute, and the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Opponents repeated familiar arguments that fracking is safe and necessary for national defense. They also warned Florida would have the toughest ban in the nation. Jake Kramer, an attorney for Collier Resources in Southwest Florida, warned senators they were making a mistake.
Large landowners won't have a choice. They'll be forced to bring dozens of high-profile and expensive takings lawsuits against the state. They'll do this because the bill will take their property rights as soon as it becomes law.
After the vote, Young stressed that the measure only bans hydraulic fracturing, not conventional drilling.
There really are no investment-backed expectations that would be taken by this regulatory exercise of the state police power. I think that we're on strong legal ground.
Democratic Senator Gary Farmer of Fort Lauderdale, an attorney, says he agrees. Drillers would be hard-pressed to prove they lost anything of value, Farmer says.
They don't know. They can't. They don't know that there's gas down there. They don't know that it's in a place where they can safely extract it.
Young has two more committee stops in the Senate, but her biggest problem will be the House. House Majority Leader Ray Rodriguez sponsored an industry-backed bill last year. He says he continues to favor more studies and strict regulations. A Central Florida Republican is sponsoring the House version, but the bill has yet to get a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Still to come on Capitol Report, State Senator David Simmons is doing a high wire act between the needs of public schools, charter schools, and the Florida House of Representatives.
I do commit to you that I will continue to work to solve this problem, so that we can do it, so that it'll be something that the House will accept.
Insurance carriers, businesses, and lawyers all blaming each other for the spike in Florida's workers' compensation rates. State lawmakers took public comment this week on a proposed fix.
Right now, essentially, you have the insurance industry setting its own rates, as they did just a few months ago, and then coming to the legislature and saying, we have a crisis.
Lawmakers divided over a mandate involving juvenile civil citations, but some say that mandate is essential.
Between 2010 and 2015, 4,202 children between the ages of 5 and 10 were arrested. That is unconscionable.
And a panel of lawmakers says it just makes sense to ban steroid use for racing greyhounds.
Support for Capital Report is provided by the Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce, The ABLE Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org.
There's renewed interest in requiring Florida's public school districts to share a portion of their locally generated school maintenance funds with charter schools. It's an argument that's been around for years, and as Lynn Hatter reports, some lawmakers are worried about what that means for the state's traditional public schools.
Charter schools are public schools operated independently of districts and with more flexibility on things like curriculum, building standards, and hiring. Florida's first charters appeared in the 1990s, and at the time they were created, longtime Florida School Board Association lobbyist Joy Frank says the industry made the state a promise.
That charter schools could do it differently, cheaper, and they would never ask for capital outlay. And those of us who were around and know how things go knew that at some point we'd be here today.
Republican Senator Tom Lee is one of the few lawmakers still around from that time.
Ms. Frank's correct. When we were pitched this idea in charter schools, these were things were going to open up in shopping centers and what have you, and there was never going to be any need for charter school capital outlay funds and that sort of thing. Well, that's changed. We are where we are.
Today, there are more than 700 charter schools in the state, and as charter school enrollment has gone up, so have funding requests. A 2011 survey found charters get less public dollars than traditional schools, and that's largely due to a gap in how construction and maintenance dollars are allocated. The state has tried to even out the disparity in recent years by awarding more state capital outlay, known as PICO funds, to the charters. But the supply of those dollars is drying up.
PICO's a dying source of revenue. It's a rounding error in all of this.
Now the Senate is proposing a solution. Bill sponsor David Simmons says he'd like to see the current tax cap of 1.5 mil raised to 2 mil. In exchange for the higher amount, districts would have to share a portion of the proceeds with charter schools. Polk County Schools' Wendy Dodge outlines her district's constraints. She says there's not enough revenue from the mills to share.
In contrast to Broward County Schools, who said they generate $250 million with their LCI, we generate about $45 million. The requirement to share with our charter schools would take about 19% of that money, or $5.2 million annually.
In its current form, the bill says districts that can't come up with the required dollars must get them from elsewhere in their budgets. Senator Tom Lee says instead of targeting local funds, the state should look at its overall education funding system.
I would like to see a more comprehensive view of how we address the situation that I know is a real problem down on the ground with capital outlay, because I'm concerned that some of the unintended consequences of where this is may be headed through disparate standards some of the higher cost students ending up in the public system is that without meaning to, we're destroying the public system.
The plan is slated to undergo further changes as it moves through the legislature. Republican Senator David Simmons says he's willing to look at other ways to fund construction and maintenance projects for both public and charter schools.
We have a crisis on our hands, and we also have a need to assure that there's equity and appropriate funding within our entire capital outlay system, whether it is to traditional public schools or to charter schools.
Simmons hopes to craft a measure that will find acceptance among state House members. The chamber's leaders have stated they're opposed to any perceived tax increase. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
House lawmakers got an earful this week on proposed workers' compensation measures. Business groups and healthcare advocates complain the draft legislation doesn't do enough to address attorney fees, premium costs, physician fees, and patient choice. We get that story from Sarah Mueller.
Workers' compensation is the health system for workers who get hurt on the job. Employees get medical care and lost wages from their employers for promising not to sue. But workers do sue when insurers deny their claims. The state law allows judges in compensation claims to make insurers pay all the attorney fees.
Right now, essentially, you have the insurance industry setting its own rates, as they did just a few months ago, and then coming to the legislature and saying, we have a crisis.
That's labor union advocate Rich Templin of AFL-CIO speaking to a House committee. He blames the insurance industry for the spike in worker comp rates. The state approved a nearly 15% increase last year when the Florida Supreme Court struck down limits on attorney fees and disability payments. Legislators want to lower the rates, but a fix may prove elusive this session. The draft legislation caps attorney fees at $250 an hour. It also ties outpatient care to the Medicare fee schedule. But retired orthopedic surgeon Fraser Cobb says that could force doctors to stop seeing workers' compensation patients. He says they're very different than Medicare patients because of the large amount of bureaucracy involved.
We need to treat these patients. I enjoy treating them. The clinic where I was before and retired treats a large number of workers' compensation patients. But if you cut back on fee schedules, you're going to cut back on access. There's no question about that.
Businesses and insurance carriers blame attorney fees for driving up the cost of workers' compensation. Florida employers are facing a $1.5 billion rate increase because of the 2016 state Supreme Court decisions. Samantha Padgett with the Florida Retail Federation says last year's 14.5% increase is hard for companies to pay. She says injured workers should pay their own attorney fees.
32 states, which includes the District of Columbia, have purely claimant-paid fees in the workers' compensation system.
But Richard Chait with the Florida Justice Association disputes that claim. He says employers and insurers are wrongfully denying claims they should pay.
They have a business model where they're building in an intention to deny benefits. Provide the benefit, and you never have to pay the attorney's fee.
Altogether, rates fell 60% after lawmakers made employer-friendly changes in 2003. But Rich Templin of AFL-CIO says those so-called reforms helped the insurance industry at the expense of both employers and workers.
The insurance folks were kind of just the middle men, if you will, and not really a party to that original agreement. And what has happened is this system and this agreement has been taken over by an industry that just seems to continue to put profits over people.
While calling out the legislation's shortcomings, business groups did praise a proposal excluding personal information on injured workers from public records. That could make it harder for lawyers to recruit clients. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
Florida lawmakers considering shutting down community redevelopment agencies, citing reports of misuse of public money. Supporters are hoping to strike a compromise before the legislature kills CRAs outright. Kate Payne reports.
Community redevelopment agencies work with local governments to improve blighted neighborhoods. They fund better roads, sidewalks, affordable housing units, and parks to improve underserved areas. Some projects are wildly popular, like Cascades Park in downtown Tallahassee. What was once an abandoned brownfield is now a community hub with trails, rolling hills, and an open-air amphitheater. Business analyst Anna Carradine works remotely and often brings her laptop here.
I think it's a nice place for people to come out and just be outside in nature and really enjoy like the weather.
But just down the hill from Cascades Park sit long empty warehouses and storefronts. Critics say the CRA should fund more projects in areas like this instead of in the trendy All Saints District a mile away.
In the CRA process, we're actually have taken away some of the local control from counties.
That's Representative Jake Rayburn, a Valrico Republican. While some CRA boards are made up of local elected officials, they're not held to the same standards as city or county commissions. Critics say they're redundant and that local governments do the same work with more transparency. Rayburn referenced a recent survey of CRAs in the state.
97% of those that responded said that similar projects could be funded by local government entities such as cities or counties. 97%, and those are the board members of the current active CRAs.
Rayburn is sponsoring a bill that would require more budget oversight and ethics training for board members. And CRA supporters are open to that. They believe the agencies are doing their job, building the environment that fosters business and community investment. Thomas Hawkins represents the planning organization 1,000 Friends of Florida.
We don't have a free market for most infrastructure. It's not a free market for putting in new water pipes or sewer pipes or roads. These are public infrastructure. And we've got to have public agencies that make these investments. So CRAs fill that gap.
Supporters say the projects ultimately add property value, which in turn increases tax revenues. But opponent lawmakers aren't satisfied. Rayburn's House Bill 13 would effectively kill CRAs. It would prevent new agencies from forming and prohibit existing groups from funding new projects after October 2017. Bill Peebles represents the Florida Redevelopment Association.
That is a nuclear option. That's a death knell for these things. And I think it will have a dramatic and a negative impact in most of your districts.
Some lawmakers are defending the programs, particularly those who served in local governments. But despite some reservations, the plan passed its first committee stop Wednesday. The Senate has not yet taken up the companion bill. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
A couple of juvenile justice-related bills are now moving in the Florida House and Senate, as we hear from Sasha Cordner.
My son is one of the success stories of the civil citation program.
Judy McGinnity's son, a juvenile at the time, was caught putting graffiti on walls.
And instead of being arrested, was given an arrest avoidance. He had to do a lot of community service, make full restitution to the property owner, and attend 12 weeks of behavior modification classes with the St. Petersburg Police Department.
And McGinnity says her son learned from his mistake.
He has not been in trouble again. He now has a job that required a level 2 background check. He never would have gotten this job had he had an arrest on his record, even if we had gotten the record expunged. We know that expunged records can still be seen on a level 2 background check. The CEO of Raymond James, pastors, school principals have all told us that when they do level 2 background checks, they see expunged records.
That's why she's against a move by the House to replace a bill initially requiring law enforcement officers to issue juvenile civil citations for certain first-time misdemeanor crimes. Now, the House bill's aim is to expunge records for those juveniles and kids applying for jobs won't have to disclose the arrest. While McGinnity says that's great, she wants Florida lawmakers to keep both parts of the bill.
We still need to hold to the original language of this bill to clarify that civil citations should be the default, and arresting children for these minor offenses should be unusual. We're looking to you to ensure that the expungement language is added to the bill and does not replace civil citation.
But Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri, also representing the Florida Sheriff's Association, says the bill in its current form is much better.
In the original version of this bill, totally, 100%, eliminated law enforcement discretion. If you have a 17-year-old kid who's 6 feet tall and weighs 250 pounds and is sitting in the St. Pete Beach with a can of beer in his hand, a baggie of pot in his pocket, yelling and screaming profanities, and he runs from the police, and the cop has to tackle him, the cop would be prohibited under the original version of this bill from arresting that kid and would be mandatory civil citation. It would also include all kinds of other things.
Barney Bishop with Florida Smart Justice Alliance has a few suggestions on how to solve the mandate problem without actually making it mandatory.
Let's start teaching law enforcement officers from the very beginning the whole concept about civil citations, both for juveniles and adults. You put it in the curriculum at the law enforcement academies about how to use their discretion and when it's appropriate.
The bill's Senate companion, which now includes the expungement provision, is different from the House proposal in that it still requires law enforcement officers to issue the civil citations. Still, both bills passed their respective committees. Another measure meant to crack down on and rehabilitate repeat juvenile offenders also advanced Wednesday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, Florida is one of the few states where greyhounds continue to race. While some are pushing for the end of the practice, others counter the industry helps ensure the dogs are well cared for. Now, as Regan McCarthy reports, lawmakers are looking into a measure intended to create more protections for the animals.
Of the 19 greyhound tracks in the United States, Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith says 12 are in Florida. The Orlando Democrat says that's just one reason Florida should end the use of anabolic steroids for its racing dogs.
What happens here could be followed in other states and in the few states where this industry still remains.
Guillermo Smith says based on his discussions with a number of veterinary experts, there's only one reason racing greyhounds are given anabolic steroids: to keep female dogs from going into heat, ensuring they can continue racing year-round. But Coral Springs Democratic Representative Jared Moskowitz has another explanation.
It's cheating! People bet on these dogs. Some of the dogs are getting steroids, some of them are not. It's cheating. How come it's cheating in every other sport, but with dog racing, it's medically necessary?
While some representatives of the greyhound industry argue there are medically necessary reasons for steroid use, saying the health of their dogs is their primary concern, Carrie Teal with the organization Grey 2K says that depends on what kind of steroids a person is talking about.
It's common to use steroids like prednisone in veterinary medicine. That's not what we're talking about. This bill addresses a very narrow type of drugs, anabolic steroids. These are the male hormone testosterone or synthetic versions of testosterone. That is specifically what we are talking about.
Some lawmakers have pushed for an exemption that would allow use of the drug for racing greyhounds in carefully regulated circumstances. But Guillermo Smith says that leaves the door open for bad actors to take advantage.
I am of the point of view that any amendments to allow for the use of steroids on these racing dogs would essentially legalize their use, because then they would use essentially any excuse available to be able to pump these dogs full of steroids so that they don't miss racing days and they can save money.
Meanwhile, Sarasota Republican Representative Alex Miller says she'd like to see an end to dog racing. But while a plan to end live racing requirements for paramutuals is moving in the Senate, it's not included in a House plan. So she says for now, Guillermo Smith's plan will have to do.
I think the expression death by a thousand paper cuts, we will have death by or death of greyhound racing by a thousand animal welfare bills, as far as I'm concerned.
The measure passed through the House Tourism and Gaming Control Subcommittee Wednesday. A similar measure has not yet been heard in the Senate. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FBR Cap Report, and please join us each weeknight at this time throughout the 2017 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.